Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20 plus years of collecting VHS films on obsolete formats, also known as films from the VHS era, though not necessarily on VHS. And we were actually intending today to review a movie on Laserdisc.
Yep.
And I can apparently now at least clean the lens of a Laserdisc. So we did not watch the intended film because our Laserdisc player needed a little help.
Yeah.
Which I gave to it, and hopefully it will now give us many more years of...
Sometimes the problem with obsolete formats is that your machines can break down or have issues or problems.
No, I mean, when you're watching things on machines that are over 20 years old at this point.
Yeah.
You have to learn to care about things like pinch rollers and belts and gear clusters and, you know, I think it's also, there's a sidebar, but, you know, that's when I was already pricing replacement Laserdisc players.
Yeah.
On eBay. And there's some out there, and there's some that are, you know, out there. A lot of them don't have remotes, the dreaded Goodwill effect.
Right.
But it is weird to think that, yeah, I mean, these complex machines that no one makes anymore, and even things like for cassettes and VCRs, the few machines that are still being produced actually are not that good.
Right.
And so, and even like Tecmoan had a video on the portable CD player, portable like Discman CD player. If you want a good one, you have to go retro now, because right. The ones that are currently... And it's weird how these things kind of pass away. And I wonder, a number of friends of ours who say, oh yeah, our Laserdisc player just stopped working one day. I wonder if it was just the lens was a little dirty like ours was. Yeah. In a can of air. You just take the cover off and it would have been fine for another 10 years or something. So it's something I think about as we get older and these machines get older. Is like, I don't think anybody's ever going to make a Laserdisc player again.
You know, and it's so funny, too, because, like, Laserdisc felt like the more prestige piece of equipment to have at the time. And they were expensive, right? And then they seemed to have, like, the more, like, Criterion collection type of film. Though they did definitely have some horror movies and B-movies.
And stuff and just crap. When we rented that made-for-TV, The Haunting of, what was
Sarah
her name?
Sarah Hardy.
That was not quality entertainment, but it was, we watched on Laserdisc. So our next review will be on Laserdisc because the Laserdisc player works. But our film for this episode is Ken Russell's Gothic.
Yeah.
From 1986, and we have it on VHS. Getting it from, actually, I believe it was the Walmart in Altoona in 1990-something, and this VHS tape was sealed until today.
We should have done an unwrapping. We should have filmed it.
We should have done an unwrapping. Well, you know, for folks who... follow us on Instagram and Facebook. I always, the new show announcements, I post a picture of the thing, and you can actually see all the cellophane trailing off in the photo. You can see the price sticker. It was $2.88. So I'm pretty sure it came out of one of those giant bins that they still have, but they're full of DVDs and Blu-rays. And also you'll see, I put the tape out, and we have to talk about this. This is a very cheap tape. This is an SLP or SSLP tape. It's a very lightweight cassette. If you look at the reel in the photo, there's not a lot of actually videotape. So it was recorded very slowly, so very cheaply, you know.
And it's probably one that will not handle multiple viewings.
No, I mean, this unsealed today, potentially already on its last list.
Because the quality was not great.
The quality was not great. There were tracking lines throughout.
Yeah.
A lot of tape hiss, which then turned into some kind of like screechy whine at in the final scenes of the film. We need to own Gothic on like Laserdisc or maybe DVD or something. I don't know. But For those of you who don't know about this film, and I don't think a lot of you do, because one of the other things we have to talk about in this episode is the way Ken Russell just kind of went away.
Yeah.
Ken Russell was once in our tour, and that's why I was like, it's Ken Russell's Gothic, damn it.
Yeah.
But he kind of he's fallen out of vogue in terms of, like, people who are into cinema. I mean, he kind of went where Brian De Palma went.
Right.
You know, though Brian De Palma kind of thinks. But anyway, so we first encountered this movie, which is about, in short, the night that one of the first vampire novels and Frankenstein was conceived.
Right.
It was a party with Lord Byron, Mary Shelley, a couple other folks, and a certain Dr. Polidori, who on a dark and stormy night in somewhere in Switzerland just said, hey, let's tell ghost stories. And the world was never the same after this party. And so Gothic is the tale of that night. Though there's not a whole lot of writing that happens. They talk about writing stories, but they actually,
don't really.
So
it's definitely a fictional take on it.
Very.
And it's almost a fevered dream take on it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, our kind of outline for these shows, the bullet point we're on right now is brief plot. And part of the issue with this movie, as, you know, the thing about Ken Russell, if you're watching a Ken Russell movie, Altered States, which we did very early in the podcast.
Yeah.
At some point, because we have a super rare copy of Dante's Inferno, not that Dante. But I'll have to do that at some point.
Right.
Ken Russell movies and plots are, if you're watching a Ken Russell movie, maybe plot doesn't matter that much to you. We just streamed, yes, we do stream films. We streamed the new Dario Argento, and, you know, you're having a mixed feelings about it. I was like, you know what? Plot and plausibility, that's not, when you're signing up for that director, that's not what you're looking for. And you almost have to see the movie a different way. So, yes, brief plot. It kind of isn't one. It becomes morning at some point. At night, these very wealthy, semi-aristocratic, or in this case, Lord Byron, properly aristocratic people are on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And all of their phobias, anxieties, and forbidden desires are on full display as they... It's almost like the less wholesome Fanny Alexander.
Yeah.
You know, where, like, most of that movie happens at night after everybody goes to bed, but people are still wandering around the house. Gothic is... Those people should be in bed, but they're not. And just weird stuff happens. There's several important scenes with leeches and body horror and fantasy and...
I said to Matt, like, it felt like the more upscale the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
There is an element, yes. Yes.
You know, and with Rocky Horror, you know, so there is questions around sexuality and gender and people sleeping with each other and weird things happening, and the night progresses and gets stranger and stranger. And I think for Rocky Horror, which, you know, is a huge cult classic now, at that time, Rocky Horror felt dangerous, right? Gothic didn't really feel like, maybe it's now being
maybe
old
today old, it's, but you know, but today, we first saw, and we should also talk about how we first encountered this movie.
Yeah.
It was through a mentor, professor, our cool artistic dad, Kenny Rosinski of St. Francis, where we met.
Yes.
And was, did we encounter, we didn't talk, you know, was it within the class on the vampire, or when we were doing Dracula, or was it the horror movie film art course?
I don't remember. So of those three.
We were in a play called Dracula, and one of the things that Kenny would do so well is when we were in a play, if there was a film that sort of captured the mood and the aesthetic that he was trying to copy.
Yeah.
We would have a play rehearsal, I put play rehearsal in scare quotes, where we would sit down and we would just watch that movie. And he's like, this is what I was thinking. You could steal bits from this.
Yeah.
So we might have actually watched, which is weird because there's, you know, We could have watched a Dracula, but no, we might have watched Gothic for Dracula. Or we did film art, the horror film, which was, we were in that class together, but before we were a couple.
Exactly.
Yes. Exactly. So one of those two places, and I will say at the time, I think I was kind of blown away by Gothic. I'd said several times earlier in this series, this podcast, we should do Gothic at some point. I want to do Gothic. You know, I've been sitting on this tape for 25 years. I want to do Gothic. Because it was, in my mind, this, like, really sophisticated, dangerous, scary, weird movie.
Yeah.
That I was like, yeah, you know. And, I don't know, we could talk about how was it watching it today in the
well, I think,
2020s.
Yeah. So there is some, like, fascinating and interesting visuals that capture you. And there's one scene where there's eyes and a woman's nipples that...
Yes!
I do remember when I saw that, like, whoa, like, that was weird. Like, seeing it when we were probably 18, 19, or 20.
Yeah, and we hadn't seen a lot of films yet.
By that point, we had not seen a lot of films. So it did feel like visually, like, interesting. And there was elements to it that you're like, this was mind-blowing. Like, how did he do that? And, you know.
And I think one of the other things is, you know, if we go lit scholarly for a second. I mean, Gothic is very Gothic.
Yes.
In terms of the definition of the Gothic as an aesthetic, that you have... That you have weird, you have eerie, you have spaces that are potentially kind of ruins, big drafty old houses that seemingly are full of mystery,
right.
That you have this sort of liminality that if it's not supernatural or psychological, or if it's not supernatural, it's definitely psychological, and that you have your sort of mundane reality and then this door opens to something else.
Right.
I think another thing that really enamored me then about the film is also that it was this kind of very sexy period piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because young people still fall into this trap when you ask them about history. And it was like everything, maybe before the 1960s, everyone was a prude and no one ever had sex.
Right.
And there was never... And... You know, people didn't discuss dangerous ideas and all of that. And one of the nice things about Gothic is it just completely blows that out of the water.
Right.
There's a huge thing about, I mean, blasphemy is a key theme of the film. Sexuality is a key theme of the film. And especially kind of edgy, dangerous, taboo sexuality is so important. And so it was nice... For me to see that in a period piece, like, yeah, man.
Yeah, it's no room with a view.
Remains
of the day.
Remains of the day, but it does have I mean, you feel like you're in on a secret.
Well, I do
when
think...
When you watch something like this.
I mean, I think the part for me that rang the most true, Lord Byron wrote Don Juan, right?
Yeah.
And that's all about sexual conquest.
Yeah.
And there has been question marks around Lord Byron's sexuality and that he was bisexual and slept with a ton of people.
Yeah.
And the same with Shelley, right? Like, Shelley is known for sleeping with lots of, even though he was married to Mary Shelley,
yeah.
He had other relationships and partners and things like that. And actually, when he met Mary, he was married. And so he ran off with like a 16, 17-year-old and left his wife. And so I think that sense of they were famous men and they had a lot of fun being famous. And I think the debauchery part of it, the part of like the sex and just kind of sleeping with who you want when you want, definitely that felt like that rang true. And I think it was important to bring that out. So as you mentioned, there is that sense of like, oh, Lord Byron wrote this or Shelley wrote this. They're very important people and the romantics, right? I mean, they're called the romantics.
Yeah.
But it really is, they are very sexual beings. So I think that part of it made them feel like real people as opposed to a poem that you read.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, too, is fascinating then, too, you know, because I had read Frankenstein in college previously in a history course, and it was the idea that maybe was Frankenstein a mile marker, watershed moment in the idea of modernity. And so there's a couple great lines in, you know, the movie, like, we are the gods now. God is already dead. It's very 19th century past. It's 1916 or 1816, but Nietzsche had happened yet somehow in the imagination, and so they could quote Nietzsche sort of. But yeah, this idea that maybe also was Shelley, Mary Shelley, a visionary who saw forward, and, you know, when Frankenstein pops up again is whenever we're maybe slightly post-human, whether it's after World War I and plastic surgery, and we could save people from battle wounds, but then have to rebuild them in ways. And as we continue to become more post-human, at what point, when will we be augmented with microchips and supervision and all of those things when we become God now? Well, that's part of the Frankenstein thing. So it's also, there's an incredible pastness or sense of history, and maybe it is a little ahistorical history. But there's also this way that maybe, yeah, Mary Shelley was a very modern woman and a very contemporary woman who still speaks to us today with this, you know, the monster's not called Frankenstein, you know. Well, but anyway.
I want to say the movie is called Megan. And it's about an AI doll that goes, like, crazy or whatever, right? And you think, like, that's a Frankenstein tale, right? So, like, you're even AI, the film AI, is a Frankenstein tale. So it's just gotten more sophisticated now, where it's electrodes and microchips, but it's still this Frankenstein tale.
And I think, again, part of the appeal of the film is this voyeurism. Like, imagine being at that party. Right. If you were that cool, that smart to be able to be at that party where somebody came up with Frank. I mean, it's the ultimate hipster. Yeah, man, I saw them the first tour with, like, 10 other people. You know, I was at the party where Mary Shelley came up with Frankenstein.
Right, I mean, it doesn't get much cooler than that.
It wouldn't get much cooler.
I would put it on my LinkedIn profile if that existed.
No, that makes a lot of sense. You'd want to be in on that. And again, I think part of what this film does so well is builds that mythology and plays with that mythology.
Yeah.
And yeah, what if they were on, you know, hallucinogenic drugs and all having sex with one another, and it was just the most wild, passionate, edgy night that you could have. even if you were, you know, trapped in what is remembered as, or in the popular imagination, usually remembered as this very chaste, stodgy century.
Right. And I think, there's this happens to everybody. You know, sometimes you shouldn't go back and revisit things because they might not hold up the way they had when you were, like, 19
when you're
or 20.
Younger and a little more naive and not as cinematically literate. So,
seeing something.
Let's talk about that.
Well, as you said, like, I mean, for me, the first big issue is there is a lack of a through line, right? So it's just literally a bunch of people taking drugs and having these crazy ass hallucinations and running around this gothic castle and encountering weird stuff. There's no through line, and you really aren't getting a sense of how Frankenstein came to be, or the vampire came,
you know,
to be.
It's, there's lightning.
Yeah.
You know, what's his face gets naked on the roof.
Shelley
gets naked on the roof. I mean, so Shelley. There's a couple moments where, all right, yeah, it almost plays that hand kind of heavy.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And so their big premise, the screenwriter's big premise, is that Frankenstein is inspired by Mary's miscarriage.
Yes.
And her wanting her child to be alive again.
Yes.
So you're getting a ton of images. You get an image of her having a miscarriage or difficult birth. You have images of dead babies. At one point, her dead son comes back to her and is talking to her. So the big premise is that. And so they spend a ton of time on the death of her child, and that's kind of about it, right? And then all these other weird encounters that everyone has at this time, and that how do you say his last name?
Polidori.
Polidori has a big crush on Byron, And so you're getting a lot of his crush on Byron and his, you know, being conflicted about his homosexuality and his interest. Now, that character is played by a person who is in the Harry Potter films. So I always love the thought of people who
Julian love... Sands.
No, that Julian Sands played Percy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's Timothy Spall.
Timothy Spall. I'm sorry. I read the box too quick.
No, it's okay. So Timothy Spall, he plays one of the villains in the Harry Potter series. Yes. And he's in like 5 or 6 of them. I always think it's funny if people are like, oh, I really like Harry Potter. I'm going to look at some of these things the other actors have done. And if they stumble upon Gothic, they're going to be completely...
Oh, yeah.
Completely traumatized. Yes. It's definitely not Harry Potter.
Yes.
But he's, you know, obsessed with Lord Byron. For me, he's a Renfield character. He very much is a Renfield character, which might be a nod because, you know, Dracula was inspired by Vampire. And so maybe it's a nod to that. But he's very much a Renfield character.
Whoa! He's very wacky. Totally wacky.
Very much master type of thing. He's following Byron around like a lost puppy dog.
Yes.
But, so, there's these kind of interesting things that are happening. When in the 1980s, this would have been shocking, right? But now, as we're older, it's not as shocking because we've watched a lot more film.
And we've watched a lot more Ken Russell's. I mean, what was the nun one called again?
Oh my goodness, that's so bad. I completely went out my
demons?
Or
angels?
I think it... Let me see.
Well, the other thing is, speaking of the 1980s, while you look that up, because we forgot.
The Devils,
of course, The Devils.
Which is a really good film.
Which is really good, which we, I think, have like a Korean Blu-ray of or something, because it's kind of hard to come by, and it's pretty wild. At some point, we should watch Lair of the White Worm again. Also, speaking of the 80s, the other thing I have to mention is... Thomas Dolby, you know, she blinded me with science. Thomas Dolby did the soundtrack. And there are also very, like, it came up in the opening credits. And I was like, oh, you know, which is also like, was like, could they not, was Danny Elfman busy that week? I mean, or was Danny Elfman not doing, you know, it's, yeah, I mean, Thomas Dolby's soundtrack comes off as the poor man's Danny Elfman soundtrack. And then also, it does sound very much like, it, you know, some of those songs could be on the, you know, I Blinded Me With Science, She Blinded Me With Science B-side tracks or whatever, which also dates the film a little bit.
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I want to talk about who's in this movie, Gabriel Byrne, who has done some really interesting films. I mean, I was thinking, like, I was not, as like, you know, as it keeps getting weirder and weirder and weirder, and you know, he's playing that character so, the you know, Lord Byron character so well, and so eccentrically, I was like, oh, you know, he probably was like, ah, Hereditary, you know, it's fine, this is just a movie, at this point in his life and career.
Yeah. But he, I mean, he was in Usual Suspects. I mean, most recently...
Usual Suspects. He was in Miller's Crossing, which is my favorite.
Yes, one of your favorite films.
Coen Brothers. What was my favorite Coen?
Coen films. Miller's Crossing is just a tremendously brilliant film.
But so here's someone who's also then has had a career playing very interesting roles.
Yes.
And certainly as not quite, well, sort of the lead in Gothic. Though it is a bit of an ensemble cast as they play their party games.
And then you have... I also feel like... so Gabriel Byrne, you expect him to play like an interesting character, like something mm-hmm. different. Julian Sands, he's an interesting guy because he actually had just come off doing A Room with a View.
Mm.
And he then did this.
Oh, which maybe that's another thing about that period because, you know... Late 80s, early 90s was very much, wasn't that the period? It was like Merchant Ivory and stuff.
Yes.
The prestige picture period piece.
Right.
Was huge back in the VHS era.
Yeah.
And I think Gothic kind of, and is Gothic a Chris Gaines movie? Right? So this is one of my theories, folks. I think it's come up in the podcast before. Chris Gaines... Which was, of course, Garth Brooks' alter ego, who looked kind of vaguely gothy. and he was too out there for the normies and too normal for the weirdos.
Yeah.
There is an element of like, well, we can have this aesthetic of the, or you know, the period piece prestige picture.
Yeah.
But then make it totally bizarre and strange, and it's Ken Russell, and it kind of fit maybe that world perfectly.
So I love
in
this.
1986.
Right.
But again, today.
So I love the idea of people seeing a room with a view and being like, oh, I like Julian Sands. He's so good. He's handsome. He is a good actor. His career kind of never took off as him as a leading man. Like he ended up doing like Arachnophobia and Warlock and things like that. So he never ended up having a prestige film type of career. But I love the thought of like a 6-year-old British woman being like, oh, I like him. Let's go see Gothic. And just be like, wait, why is there eyes in her breast? I don't get it.
Why is there leeches in the food? You know, yeah. I mean, yeah. There are some great visuals in this film.
Yeah.
And maybe the part of our... Again, this is a very bad VHS copy that we have of it. I mean, there was, again, that period, you know, in that era where some tapes were just cheaper manufactured than others. You don't have this problem with streaming, folks. You might have problems with your Wi-Fi connection and your internet speed, depending on what part of the country you live in.
Right.
But you could actually have a physical thing that wasn't very good, and this one isn't.
This is true. This is true. And I think I did want to mention really quick. So in part of the fever dream, like the very last dream that Mary has is of everyone's future. And so Lord Byron does die on the field of battle and is actually being, they're bleeding him leeches, trying to help him. Claire, that Claire and Lord Byron's daughter dies very young, and she was not allowed to see her daughter, and you know you can is in it and on a and the other side of the fence angry about it. Shelley drowns, you know, so she has the vision of everyone's future of what happens to them, which that for me was I think like the best part of the film, that she has that she's prophetic, that she can see the future, right. And Frankenstein is a part of the future, as you mentioned, of modernity. That's my favorite part of the film, where she has this view of what happens to them.
And since there really isn't a plot, I don't think we're spoiling it. The last scene, I think, is also fascinating because it's modern-day tourists.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very modern-day for 1986. I saw a few members-only jackets on the tourist boat looking at the house. It's like, oh, and that's the house where they came up with Frankenstein. I find that fascinating, too.
Mm-hmm.
And is that a comment about how sometimes, whether it's nostalgia or ignorance, or is nostalgia just a form of ignorance, where we misunderstand the past and we try to kind of scrub the past and make it wholesome.
Yeah.
In a strange way.
Yeah.
And it does that. So are we ready for the four big questions?
Yeah.
I think there's some other things we have to talk about, but I think they come under the auspices of the four big questions. Question one, is it camp, retro, classic, or just an old movie?
For me, it's like... It's just felt like an old movie for me at this point in time. I didn't feel like the energy I felt the first time I watched it.
Yeah.
And you know me, like there's some movies, you know, like The Shining, The Changeling. I'll rewatch those movies a million times because there is still something that connects to me, right? Like The Changeling. Yeah. That scene, that beginning scene with his family, just still gets me. And I think George C. Scott does such a great job
playing in that film. I mean, so, Kubrick and The Shining, so good.
Yeah. So there's film. There's
some Bergmans like that.
Yeah,
that,
they're
know.
So old. There are some films that I can still revisit and still find an interesting part of it or a spark around this. This one, I actually kind of got to the point where I felt bored with it.
You did fall asleep for a little bit.
I did, because there's no through line.
There is no through line.
There's no through line.
And there's no rising action. It's not like it's going to get later and things are going to get weirder, or there's this thing that has to be solved.
And it just, it kind of gets, very talky. And then there's just so many times that you're like, oh, another shot of her dead baby. Like, I don't mean that in like a cruel way. It's just like, you get hit with that image so many times that it just doesn't have an impact anymore.
Yes. Yeah. So question two, what about the social...
Well, you didn't mention...
Oh, I will call it retro. Think I have to... I guess maybe because I do have that attachment and it was a Kenny film and, you know, also, I held onto this tape for 20 years and I never watched it. So I better like it. And I only paid $288 for it, so this that's quite
true.
A deal.
I mean, it is a worth that investment of $288.
Yes. Yeah. That in that way, as a retro film, I had like, oh, you know, well, it was, that's what we did in the 80s. That's what was avant-garde. Remember when Ken Russell was a true auteur? You know, well, I found out actually the last thing Ken Russell ever did was he did a short that was like an edgelord short that was like a Hitler for a kitten for Hitler or something.
Weird.
Like, yeah, and then he died.
The guy who did Tommy.
Yes, did a kitten for Hitler or something like that.
Weird.
Yeah, which was then posted online on some comedy site. It's an 8-minute short.
Okay.
Whatever. So let's talk about question two, about the social political distance.
So I think this is the part that pulled me out of the film.
Yeah.
And I think, so, you know, the... It heavily, heavily insinuates that Mary Shelley didn't really write the book, right? Or that, like...
Or it was the genius of the men around her...
Exactly.
...that inspired the book, or at least...
Yeah. And so you have at one point, I want to say, Shelley said... it's alive or something like that.
Oh, it's alive. And this, you know, it's the doctor who maybe believes that, yes, I think lightning could put life back into a person or something like that. And it comes off as this weird, like, there's no way a woman would have thought of that.
Yeah. And that part really bothered me. So it did come off very heavily that they kind of fed her the ideas.
And she just kind of was the recording secretary.
Exactly. And I think what we have, with deeper research into Mary Shelley and looking at her works, what they have said now is like that Shelley, he just did more like grammar. Like, you needed a period here as opposed to ideas. So it kind of diminishes her role in Frankenstein, which bothered me. Because it is, I mean... Modern horror and modern sci-fi are, Frankenstein is the bedrock for that, right?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of upsetting that they kind of take her agency away around this. The other thing is that she's a fragile flower in this film, like a massively fragile flower. And so for the woman who supposedly lost her virginity to Shelley on her mother's grave...
Which is pretty hardcore.
Hardcore. Also, like, she was able to hang with Byron and Shelley. I'm thinking she's not that massive of a fragile flower, right?
Yes.
And so I think that also is kind of frustrating, is that she, of the three, is the most wilting flower-esque. And also, her and Shelley and Claire... We're kind of a threesome who went together everywhere, right? And so also, it seems like she was a pretty open-minded, free spirit type of a person.
Yes.
So I think that kind of took it out. Like, when that started happening, when they were starting to quote, like, lines from Frankenstein, and the men were quoting lines from Frankenstein and putting out these ideas that were very much a part of Frankenstein, it did come off as her being the secretary.
Yeah, I mean... you would hope of that movie today, you know, you could say that maybe things came out of conversation, or she made point, or she would make some of the points in those conversations.
Right.
You know, it's one thing, genius is this collective thing, especially writing. It's so important in my writing career to have a community of writers. I think it's important to have contemporaries. You think of, like, music scenes, all of those things.
Right.
People bring out the best in one another.
Exactly.
But yeah, in this film, it does come off as the men were the big thinkers. Yeah. And it's, besides, we got to get busy with the boobs and the eyes and the...
Right.
and the leeches and the just blood drinking and the sex and it's just the lightning crashes a lot. It's very dark and stormy that night.
And you know, and a loss of a child is hugely traumatic, right? It's hugely traumatic. But they also don't explore her background at all.
No.
I mean, her mother died within days of having her. And so she grew up knowing that her mother died shortly after having her. Growing up under the ghost of her mother, right? Like and so that also isn't explored because, like, that's pretty a core memory a child would have.
Yeah, and you think, like, again, she's such herself a fascinating, complex human being.
Yeah.
And you know, it's part of the, you know, it's part of this idea behind the Bechdel test or whatever, that women can be fascinating human beings with thoughts and original thoughts, even.
And even, and her father actually... I mean, she would not have had necessarily the opportunity to go to college, right? Or go to formal schooling. And her father actually provided schooling for her and educated her. And so she would have been well-read. She would have definitely read her mother's work and her father's work, right? They were both famous philosophers, right? So I think, it just bothered me because she's such a fascinating woman.
Who's reduced in this.
And who's reduced in it. And actually, Claire... has the more prominent role, right? So Claire is the much more... Who is her stepsister, you know, and... but not blood-related. It was marriage, right? Combined family for marriage. But Claire is actually the more dynamic, interesting kind of female in the film. But that kind of bothered me. Like, it really bothered that she had such a diminished role.
Yes.
And then, you know... The part, though, that I think is interesting is that you do have to wonder if the vampire in Vampyr is Lord Byron, right? Because you do get a sense that he does kind of suck the energy out of people and does take advantage of people. And so I thought that part was also kind of...
Interesting
of him, how he's using sex to take advantage of people. That was interesting as well.
All right, question three. Excuse me, it's going to be late. What about the technical distance? This is a retro film.
Right. It's set in the past. It's set in a castle. You're not expecting.
It's from 1986. There are only practical effects.
The soundtrack, as you mentioned.
Doesn't quite match up because, again, she blinded me with science.
that definitely kind of sometimes... is awkward the way
it's fitted together. And also it's the other way you can describe the soundtrack is in places it comes off like Thomas Dolby trying to do the Beetlejuice soundtrack first.
This is true.
It's like somebody doing a knockoff soundtrack of the Beetlejuice soundtrack but a couple years before Beetlejuice.
The other weird thing for me, and this like felt like Ken Russell purposely put it in there, of having like the two girls chase after Shelley and trying to tear his clothes off.
Yeah.
And you know he did that so people be like, oh, he's like a rock star.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, you know, I think most people going into Gothic would know who Shelley was, right? That was kind of weird for me. Like, that was a very modern aesthetic to have like these tween girls be like, ah, Shelley, let me rip your clothes off. That kind of came off weird to me.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, the final question. Will we ever watch it again?
Well, you did spend $288 for it.
I did spend $288 for it. So, maybe we got our money out of it.
I mean, we'll definitely keep it. You'll probably, sooner than me, be like, we should rewatch Gothic. Probably in a few years, I'll be like, oh, okay, let's rewatch it again.
I think I would like to rewatch it. On DVD or streaming. I think the other thing is, folks, if you don't know Ken Russell, if you don't, maybe haven't really liked Ken Russell because the plots are always weird. It's one of those where, okay, this is a brand, this is an aesthetic. You go to a Ken Russell movie to see weird stuff and interesting visuals. And you almost have to kind of, you know, I know... we've been trained in school and we've been trained by other media to read things for plot and character. Plot and character development. Plot and character development. See a Ken Russell movie? See some weird stuff. Almost look at it like, you know, like you would at a painting.
Yeah, I mean,
you have to look at it, you have to experience it in that way and watch it on that level rather than, I think is part of how we saw this movie,
mm-hmm.
I want you to live that aesthetic on a stage,
mm-hmm.
and help me make that aesthetic for an audience.
Right.
As opposed to, well, you know, and the thing Lord Byron learned on that night was none of that. And so for a movie that depends on that,
yeah,
a super cheap, slow speed copy of Gothic on VHS maybe doesn't get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe getting some of those visuals in, you know, a nice 4K restoration or something.
That's a valid point.
It might make the film a bit more enjoyable.
I
will watch it again, but probably never watch this tape again.
I will say that for, like, Ken Russell, Tommy is probably his most famous, right?
Yeah.
And Tommy is kind of out there and visually interesting. Yeah. That might be a good place to start. I prefer The Devils. I'm a fan of The Devils.
The Devils is going hard. Lair of the White Worm is also quite legendary.
Yeah.
And we have an episode on Altered States, so you can go back to the archives.
Where Altered States is...
make them watch the episode. Make them listen to the episode.
I guess for me, like, I would rewatch it, and I think it's a valid point to watch it on in a better format.
Yes.
I think that's it.
That is it.
Though I would say go see The Devils. But
see The Devils. See The Devils.
All right.
And Lair of the White Worm.
I think that's it.
That's it.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Watch Gothic 2. After you've watched those other two. Bye.